From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we'll explore how opponents to the bills passed during Wisconsin's lame duck session may mount a constitutional challenge.
Later, John Goerda adds a post-millennium chapter to his landmark book, The Making of Milwaukee.
I do feel a responsibility, as long as I can, keep this book in print and up to date for whatever generation of readers know who is here. So yes, this is something that, you know, looking back in 50 years from now, people will make their own judgments about whether I was right or wrong.
Ann Christensen aims her metaphorical critic's pen at the city's best new restaurants.
My idea, if you really held me to it, my idea of new is a year. But in other people's minds, you know, something that opened maybe a year and a half or almost even 2 years ago, that's still really new.
And on Bubbler Talk, we learn the history of Milwaukee's most visible tugboat.
Lake Effect is next after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. This week, Republican state lawmakers advanced bills that would strip power from both the incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Democratic Attorney General-elect Josh Call.
For one, the new bills would require a legislative committee rather than the Attorney General to sign off on withdrawing from lawsuits. This would prevent Call from withdrawing from a national lawsuit that's seeking to invalidate the Affordable Care Act.
The legislation also makes it easier for lawmakers to get involved in litigation over state statutes, gives them power over spending settlement money, and gets rid of the newly formed Solicitor General's office. The legislation now goes to outgoing Republican Governor Scott Walker, who has indicated he plans to sign the bills into law.
Marquette Law Professor Chad Oldfather explains to Lake Effect's Mayon Silver that we're seeing a last-minute maneuver to shift power from the executive branch to the legislature.
Traditionally, the model of separation of powers, of course, has three branches. There's the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary, which we're not worried about here, at least right now. And one would imagine it to be part of the executive power to oversee litigation undertaken by on behalf of the government, in this case, the state of Wisconsin. And what the legislature here is really trying to do is to give itself a little bit more of a role in that process than has traditionally been the case.
How much more of a role is it looking for at this point? What is it trying to do?
Well, I think it's fair to say there are a couple things going on, the largest of which over the longer term is this ability of the legislature to intervene in litigation, presumably if it doesn't like the way the Attorney General is representing the interests of the state. There's, of course, also this provision in there that allows the legislature to make the decision regarding whether to remain in litigation, which I think everyone understands is mostly driving at staying in the case that's challenging the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, but that could have implications over the longer term as well.
Rewinding. So the Attorney General's office has these different prongs of things that it can do for the state of Wisconsin, you know, bring the state of Wisconsin into federal lawsuits, defend the state of Wisconsin against lawsuits. On that defending against lawsuits component, is the legislature, has it been able to intervene in those types of lawsuits? What does it mean to intervene in the first place?
Well, so I think the notion of intervention is exactly as it sounds like it might be. A party that intervenes in a lawsuit is traditionally an institution or a person that is otherwise not a party to the lawsuit in the sense that it's one of the actual litigants, but believes that it has a point of view that ought to be put into the mix. And really, so what the legislature is doing here is saying, if we don't like the way the Attorney General is conducting this case, we want the ability to interject into the proceedings and put forth our own point of view. And it really presents an interesting sort of situation potentially where you could have two entities purporting to speak on behalf of the state. And it's not entirely clear how that would work in operation and how that might shake out in terms of situations where the state's view as the state needs to be credited.
So it would make it a lot easier for the legislature to get an attorney to intervene on its behalf than before.
Right.
What are the ramifications of that?
in a sense, it's not clear. I mean, I think in the short term, the understanding is that, and this is how it's been articulated by the Republicans in the legislature, that there have been legislative accomplishments they have achieved over the past 8 years that they want to preserve. And the fear is that with the change to a Democratic governor and a Democratic attorney general, that they will use their positions to either not advance the goals that the legislature and Governor Walker were meaning to advance through that legislation, that they would really take steps to attempt to undermine what the Republican legislature feels it has accomplished. And so over the short term, it wants to preserve those gains. And that's really as far as I've seen the justifications going. It's really not a situation, or so it seems to me, where anyone is advocating these changes based on some conception that it is some good government measure in general, that this is really a better way of doing business over the long term. All of the debate has been very short-term focused.
And what about the provisions that would allow lawmakers to more easily hire private attorneys when they're sued for violating open records law? What do you make of that?
There certainly has been some litigation in the state recently involving open records laws. And I imagine there's a sense, perhaps, that the incoming attorney general would be less inclined to advocate on behalf of members of the legislature when it comes to opposing those requests than some folks might otherwise like, such that this would give them the option of representing themselves a little bit more vigorously if they felt it were appropriate to do so.
What would the ramifications be if legislators were able to hire private attorneys to defend them?
Well, it's certainly going to cost money in a way that turning to the attorney general would not, because you're paying an additional outside lawyer to do it. In terms of how much, that would depend entirely upon how often this provision were relied upon.
So apparently there were some requests that the attorney general would get legislative approval to withdraw from lawsuits and to decide whether or not to settle or to spend settlement money. What are the ramifications of that?
Well, again, I think it's just, without getting into specifics, the idea here seems to be we don't want to have that much power or that particular piece of power delegated to someone we disagree with. The defenses of this entire package of legislation have tended to be along the lines of we didn't need to worry about this when it was Governor Walker because we were on the same page with him in terms of what he was going to do. Now we've got these new people coming in. We're not on the same page with them. And so we're not as likely to be willing to give them the discretion to, whether it's allocation of settlement funds, whether it's handling of litigation, to conduct those things as we were when it was Governor Walker and Attorney General Schimmel.
Another aspect was apparently the Solicitor General's office. Did you follow anything about that? Apparently it oversees high-profile litigation. What would that mean to eliminate the Solicitor General's
office? Well, the Solicitor General's office was a new thing under Attorney General Schimmel. And as I understand it, it was implemented at his request. And as you described it, it's exactly what it is. It's this group of, in the one instance that there is, the group that has served under Attorney General Schimmel, of some really highly qualified lawyers whose job it was to advocate the interests of the state, of the Attorney General in high-profile litigation. So kind of, you know, setting up this, I suppose it's fair to say, elite group of lawyers within the Attorney General's office that was really responsible for the higher profile stuff, for the constitutional type litigation. It wasn't something that the state of Wisconsin had before. It is something that many but not all other states have. It's something that exists at the federal level. And I think the label Solicitor General's office tends to lend a certain amount of prestige to it that might not otherwise be there. And, you know, I'm not sure what the justification is for doing away with it other than, again, we were fine with it when it was our guy. And now that it's not our guy, we don't think it's such a good idea anymore.
What do the legal challenges look like to what the Republican legislature is doing with these bills? Let's say the bill is passed into law. Do you anticipate any litigation specifically in relation to the Attorney General's power?
I think there will be litigation. And that litigation could take two different forms. One could be a challenge in federal court. The difficulty there is that, in general, the United States Supreme Court and thus United States constitutional law has afforded states a lot of flexibility in terms of structuring their government so that there's not a lot of support in federal constitutional law for the idea that certain divisions of power within state government are required. So that's a possibility. I don't think the likelihood of success there is so great. The other avenue of challenge would be through the state courts. And the argument there would be that what the legislature has done here runs afoul of the Wisconsin Constitution. And there, too, it's a little bit hard to say exactly how that might shake out. State constitutional law, particularly when it comes to things like separation of powers, doesn't tend to be an especially large body of law, so that you can't point to a lot of specific past cases for really specific guidance. Ultimately, it would be the sort of case that would come before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And, you know, if one accepts the caricature of the court, it is a conservative court. And if that caricature were to hold true, one would expect that these changes would be upheld. Now, you know, that's perhaps being a little bit unfair to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They'll have to consider what the Wisconsin Constitution requires and whether this is allocating power amongst the branches of government in a way that is not authorized by the state constitution.
Boiling it down, you see mostly separation of powers arguments here then, right?
Right, right.
Has there been any litigation around the country on legislatures trying to do this?
There's certainly been litigation in states relating to state legislatures, I'll use the somewhat loaded phrase, encroaching upon the prerogatives of the state legislative branches. Now, mostly that has related to things like another piece of this legislation, which is an effort to put the legislature more in control of certain appointments to administrative agencies and so forth that have traditionally been given to the governor. Less so, as at least as far as I've been able to determine, less so with respect to these divisions between the legislature and the attorney general. And even to the extent that those other cases exist, you know, it may be that Wisconsin follows a different template from those other states, because one of the things that does seem to be true about the attorney general in Wisconsin is that the powers of the attorney general are not, for the most part, derived from the state constitution, but rather from legislation. So in other words, it's the Wisconsin legislature that has the primary responsibility for saying, here's what the attorney general's job is. So certainly, I think they're anticipating that they'll be relying on that as they defend the constitutionality of this.
So some states have the powers of the attorney general come from the constitution itself and not from the legislature?
Right. So you might expect to see in some state constitutions a provision that creates the office of the attorney general and defines its powers. The Wisconsin Constitution really has very little to say about the attorney general other than that the attorney general shall be elected, and most of the rest of the power, the specifics of the power, comes through legislation.
The legislators involved have indicated that basically they've given partisan reasons for doing what they're doing. And that's what you're saying as well, that, you know, there was no efforts or moves made to do any of this while there were Republicans, the same party, in those positions, right?
Right.
And so given that partisan acknowledgments for all these actions, do you think that would play a role in a court determining whether or not it's constitutional or not?
Traditionally, and here I'm going to look to the United States Supreme Court as a model, which state Supreme Courts often do as well. The United States Supreme Court has, for the most part, said, we're not in the business of asking why a legislature did what it did. We'll simply ask whether it could. So I suspect, right, that what the argument on behalf of constitutionality here will look like is we have the power to do this because the powers of the Attorney General are statutorily driven. We're just passing statutes that are outlining the powers of the Attorney General and adjusting them some. And we can do that. And sure, maybe the reasons we talked about were partisan reasons, but that doesn't mean it's not okay. So the Supreme Court would not be in the business of asking, well, you know, were you really thinking about long-term consequences? Were you really doing this because you thought it was the best way to govern the state as opposed to a way to preserve your gains over the last 8 years? And I think the argument in response would be, that may be true as a general matter, but this goes too far. That this is taking something that is traditionally within the purview of the executive branch and giving it to the legislature. So yes, as a general matter, legislature, you have the authority to define the powers of the Attorney General, but you can't take them away to such an extent that you unduly undermine the ability of the executive branch to do its job as the executive.
And when you look at the things that is reportedly happening with these bills, what strikes out at you as the most potentially challengeable action?
I mean, I think that the provisions that give the legislature a role in litigation are the ones that, to me, look like they are taking traditionally executive-type actions and responsibilities and giving them to the legislature. And that, it seems to me, is the strongest sort of separation of powers type argument. I think the Solicitor General's office doing away with that, that's not something that really is going to be much of the basis of a basis for challenge. The allocation of settlement funds, I don't know that that necessarily will be a strong basis for challenge. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
So what about the joining or getting out of lawsuits?
Well, and I think that that's the sort of thing that seems like the job of the executive, right? That at the, if we think of it at the federal level, right, the Attorney General there much more clearly is under the president, who has the ability to direct the Office of the Attorney General in terms of what litigation the United States is in or not in and what positions it's taking. It's not Congress that gets to do that. And here, the argument would be, legislature, it's your job to pass laws. It's the job of the executive branch, the governor, the attorney general, to put those laws into effect, which means administering them, which means litigating to advance them as appropriate or to defend them as appropriate. And that the legislature's job, if it's not satisfied with how the executive is implementing the laws, is to change the laws, to tighten them up, to allow less discretion rather than to reserve for itself the ability to say, no, this is how you implement it.
I see. Okay. So does this put Attorney General Call in an odd position of having to defend a law that strips power from him at some point down the line?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't know how that's going to work. I don't know. That's a really because one could imagine him saying, it's my job to defend laws, and I don't think this one's defensible. But I don't think that's how this is going to unfold.
And then, of course, the legislature could hire an intervener and have an intervener argue position.
Right.
Is that technically what could happen?
Or? I think that may be where this ends up. Who knows? It's really unclear how this is all going to unfold.
All right. Well, thank you, Chad Oldfather.
Thank you very much.
Chad Oldfather is a professor of law at Marquette University Law School. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver.
Keep listening. We'll take a quick break and then chat with John Gerda about the most recent chapter of Milwaukee history. Literally. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR right after this.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. For nearly 20 years, one of the go-to contemporary sources on Milwaukee history has been John Gerda's book, The Making of Milwaukee. The book was first published in 1999 and tells immaculately researched stories from the area's earliest settlement through the cultural, political, and business landscape here at the turn of the century.
But while there were some revisions in subsequent editions, it was not until now that The Making of Milwaukee brought readers fully into the 21st century. The new edition of the book is just out and includes an entirely new chapter that covers Milwaukee history from 2000 to the present. John Gerda joins us ahead of the launch event for the book on Saturday. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Mitch.
So, you know, the first thing that jumps out at me in reading the updated part of the book, the latest chapter, the post-millennium chapter, is how odd it feels to be reading this in the past tense.
I think that's true. I mean, history is walking into this room. So it's very recent. But the difficulty in writing that last chapter was it's very much in your face. So trying to decide, you know, what's going to last.
I wondered about that, right? As a historian, is it more challenging to evaluate the present or the recent past than a distinct period from long ago?
Much more so. I think as I wrote in the book, if you look far enough back, the signposts stand up obligingly. So they almost announce themselves. Eras and epochs, breakdowns and breakthroughs. But for instance, in this last chapter, what impact will Foxconn have? The election had not been held when we were about to go to a press, so Tony Evers is now in the index. And that was a late ad. So these things are so present that any perspective is just about impossible. At the same time, you know, responsibly, you have to say this is part of what's going on in Milwaukee in the 21st century.
As we look at the last 18 years, there are obviously things that if you were writing this book, you know, 50 years from now, mm-hmm. that would have been forgotten about. Do you feel some responsibility to keep that from happening at some level? Is there, you know, as the historian, do you get to decide that this will from here on out be history? I mean, it seems like a flip question, but
in some ways it's an awesome responsibility. In some ways, in other ways, it's kind of you know, who cares? You know, it's kind of you're sort of looking at one version, one person's version of one community's past. But I do feel a responsibility to, as long as I can, keep this book in print and up to date for whatever generation of readers, you know, who is here. So yes, this is something that you know, looking back in 50 years from now, people will make their own judgments about whether I was right or wrong. But I felt a responsibility to keep this current.
So let's talk about this latest chapter. You start in a really interesting place. What inspired you to look at the data center at, what is it, 32nd and Highland as a place to kick off the new millennium?
The book has always begun with a Wednesday at the Potawatomi Casino. And there's so much symbolism there because you're looping back, obviously, to Native times in Milwaukee. And the return of Natives to their ancestral ground, and the Menominee Valley having been a hugely important source of riches for the ancestral tribes here, and now under a very different dispensation, it is a critical source of wealth for the current tribe. And again, that line about reclaiming that wealth one gambler at a time. So that was the opening of the book and has been in all the editions. And so here you are, you know, 20 years later, and you've got the Potawatomi tribe is essentially hedging its bets on gaming and opened a $36 million data center in the Concordia neighborhood, which is essentially a hotel for the computers of businesses, nonprofits, large organizations. You know, with apparently data lines that are the size of fire hoses kind of going in there. So it's just a very neat kind of a comeback, internally, almost like music. You kind of come back in music, you sort of go back to the theme. So begin the book on the theme of Native wealth and close the book on the next generations, the coming generations. Capacity to reinvent itself and look ahead to a new technological future. So that was a kind of a neat kind of a connection to make.
Well, and also it kind of speaks as a larger metaphor for the community's reinvention of itself.
Absolutely. And kind of looking back at the kind of the foundation of history, but you're kind of moving forward on a basis of technology. And that has changed everything in terms of how we communicate, how we work, and how we look ahead to our own futures.
The other image that really stayed with me was this imagining of a night flight over Lake Michigan and how the lights, you know, have spread out from Chicago in the recent years.
You know, I've done that actual flight coming from the south. A lot of us have kind of coming up the center of Lake Michigan when you're coming from the south, Charlotte or Atlanta, someplace down south. And the comparison was within the early days, it would have been the soft incandescent glow that you would barely have seen from cruising altitude. And now you've got these pools of light in Chicago, and that's pretty much continuous up to the state line, and then pools of light in Kenosha, then Racine, then Milwaukee, and the terminal darkness going all the way up into the UP. And the point I was trying to make is that even as we have, you know, the essential story of Milwaukee being its own story, you know, very distinctive, very unique, it's also part of this emerging region that will, in the next generation or two, be one continuous pool of light from South Bend to Madison and up into the Fox Valley. So you have everything taking place in the Milwaukee area has to be seen in the context of this kind of, I called it runaway regionalization. And where you see that really, I mean, look at Foxconn and Uline and Amazon, that whole corridor down to I-94, a lot of change going on.
Right, and I think if we looked at the lights from that corridor today, it would be a fairly narrow band extending north from, say, Kenosha to Milwaukee. But I wonder if 5, 6, 10 years from now, that band will have gotten wider and wider.
It'll be wider and longer, and I think you see it especially going west to Madison. Now there are people commuting in both directions, you know, from Jefferson or Lake Mills. And it'll be a longer time coming, but I'll see the band going up to the Fox Valley as well. So certainly a huge change.
The last 18 years in Milwaukee have really represented sort of a sea change in politics as well. You, I think, alluded to this earlier in the interview, but at the dawn of the millennium, it was really, there was a fairly long-held stability in local and regional politics.
Absolutely.
Here.
In 2000, things were pretty much, as they had been for some time. 1988 was kind of a watershed election. Dave Schultz becomes kind of the new guy in the county executive seat, and John Norquist as mayor of Milwaukee. So those two were kind of the next generation, but they sort of fell into that long-term pattern of stability, you know, long tenures. Schultz less so, certainly, but Norquist was there for, you know, until 04. So you have, you know, this feeling of longevity, stability. The pension scandal hits, the caucus scandal hits, and the wheels really fall off the bus. And then you have, you know, the rise of Scott Walker as a reformer coming in and kind of riding the pension scandal to his term as county executive for 8 years from 2002 to 2010. And that set the stage for certainly much more happening on the state level. So it was really tumultuous politically and remains so.
Remains so, although you make the point that that Mayor Barrett came into office at a really tumultuous period, but has subsequently been reelected by fairly substantial margins. At some point, you would imagine, whether it's the next election or some election down the road, there's going to be, you know, we're going to return to a time of turnover.
We will, and we will have a black mayor. In the next generation, but certainly probably early in the next generation, we'll have a black mayor because the city's population is around 40% African American. So that's the next kind of change that we'll see.
The other change that has happened at a fairly rapid rate in downtown and spreading a little bit out of downtown is just the physical appearance of the city, whether you're talking about the Menominee Valley or the skyscrapers on the lakefront.
It's been remarkable. I recall a magazine story back in the 80s. I think it was Milwaukee Magazine talking about the now downtown's done. that renovation, right, right. You know, it really changed it. No, you have just this remarkable capacity for cities to reinvent themselves, reimagine themselves. And I was surprised to find that since 2005, this is not on the drawing boards. This is projects that are either in the ground or going into the ground. $5 billion of reinvestment, that is unprecedented. We have never had, you know, that level of investment in downtown Milwaukee. And it's not just downtown. You've got the Menominee Valley. Someone, I was doing a tour a couple of years ago for class of 1955 from Shorewood and Whitefish Bay High Schools. Some of these folks had not been to Milwaukee in 40 years, took them to the valley. They did not recognize the place. They did not know where they were physically. So that transformation is going on. The Harbor District is, I think, the next Menominee Valley between downtown and the Bayview neighborhood. You know, that area is just brimming with energy. The area kind of farther north along Commerce Street, Brewers Hill, moving up into Harambe. So a lot of vectors of energy kind of spreading out. So it's been a remarkable transformation.
And interesting, at the dawn of the millennium, the Park East Freeway still existed.
That's right. And that was a lot of, you know, the Park East was a very expensive off-ramp. You know, it took people from the freeway, the 43, into downtown. John Norquist spent a whole lot of political capital having that torn down, and it gave Milwaukee a sizable area of land to develop in the very, very heart of town. That doesn't happen very often in urban America. So what you have there, obviously, is the Fiserv Forum, the entertainment district, hotels, housing. So there's been just, again, a transformation there. And up in the northwest corner, the Pabst redevelopment, Joe Zilber's group has really taken that on. So what had been pretty much a dead corner of downtown is just surging with life.
You say northwest. That's the northwest corner of downtown.
Right.
There is a vast portion of Milwaukee that's still kind of waiting for that.
And it's kind of the downtown area and kind of the adjacent neighborhoods. And at the same time, you know, you don't want to push the Dickensian model of the tale of two cities. But that's going on here as it is going on in Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Detroit. And it's all around the urban north especially, where you have, as deindustrialization has continued, you have catastrophic unemployment, and the near north side especially. So those neighborhoods north of Harambe, Amani, Metcalf Park, the whole area around Lindsay Heights, they were really hammered by the Great Recession of 2007-2008, foreclosures, teardowns. So there's been just the term I think I used was Detroitization, like in the Lindsay area. That population's gone down from 40-something to 5,000 or 6,000 in the years since 1950 or so. So certainly there has been, counterbalancing all the positive developments going on in the central part of the city, there's been continuing misery, continuing distress.
At the same time, as a historian, it must be interesting to look back at pictures from, say, 1950 and see streetcars, and look at pictures from the end of 2018 and see streetcars.
Yeah, there's kind of a deja vu all over again kind of going on down there. And the HOP, I think certainly the important thing to note there is that it was kind of use it or lose it federal funding. And I think of it as sort of a starter line. Now it's 2.1 miles. So with the coach here, it'll be 2.5 going out to the lake. But I think the real test is how much we get into the habit of the HOP and how much impetus there is for expanding that line.
Well, that'll be something for the fifth edition.
You're right.
John Goerda, congratulations on edition number 4, and we'll talk to you again soon.
See you. Thank you, Mitch.
Historian John Goerda is the author of numerous books on Milwaukee, including the latest edition of his book, The Making of Milwaukee, which is just out. He'll talk about it tomorrow at 11 a.m. at the Milwaukee County Historical Society on Old World 3rd Street. He'll also sign books and chat with people next Saturday at Boswell Book Company.
If you are looking for someplace to eat, perhaps after a book talk, dining critic Ann Christensen shares some of her favorite new restaurants when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And And I'm Joy Powers. Ann Christensen eats in a lot of restaurants each year in her role as dining critic for Milwaukee Magazine. Some of them are high-profile places with lines out the door and tables booked days in advance. Others are more under the radar.
Ann writes about what she thinks of as the best new restaurants in town in the December issue of the magazine, and she's here to talk about a few of them. Nice to have you here, Ann.
Thank you.
So the cover story is Best New Restaurants. By new, how new are we talking about?
Excellent question, because my idea, if you really held me to it, my idea of new is a year. But in other people's minds, you know, something that opened maybe a year and a half or almost even 2 years ago, that's still really new. So I went back a little bit further into, I would say, the past couple of years.
But in general, you sort of want to give a restaurant a time to kind of grow into its own.
Yes, and I believe that maybe more than ever. And I think part of the problem is, and I am part of this problem, you know, all the people, the media that writes about restaurants, we want to be on top of all these openings, right? And so it is very unusual for a restaurant to just sort of squeak by without anybody noticing that it opened or that it's in the process of opening. And then it just gets slammed right away. And I have yet to see many restaurants that are like on top of their game immediately. It takes a while. It's natural. It's to be expected, really.
It's got to be a little tough for the restaurant, too, because they want a lot of attention when they first open so that people know to come there. But at the same time, they must know that it's going to take a while to get their sea legs.
Yes. A lot of them know they have kinks to work out. Believe me. It is not something that is, I mean, in most respects, it's not a mystery to them that maybe the service needs help. Maybe this particular dish on the menu isn't quite there yet. But they, so many restaurants, I mean, they're at the point where they gotta open and start making money. They have to. So they've got to get it together. And somehow, and many of them, I should say, they're not just like doing it on their own. Now they're working with regular customers coming in and getting their feedback and having to address those things then.
So let's talk about some of the specific restaurants that make it onto the list. And let's talk about the first one that you write about, which is a place called Birch and Butcher. And I'm intrigued. The colors in the image are incredibly warm. And I think it feels like it conveys something about the food.
The restaurant is so focused on the cooking implement in that restaurant, which is this hearth, which is a hearth unlike any hearth that I know of in any local restaurants here. They had it, you know, built into this space. And, you know, within, you know, I was talking to the owner, Miles Borgrafe, with, you know, for months going into this. And his goal was always to get like 60 to 70% of the menu items are going to be cooked in that hearth. And I think he's doing that. In the morning, he's doing bagels. They have all sorts of breads. Now, this is a restaurant where you can order bread service. That's a new thing. You know, people often expect bread to come pro bono to the table. That's not always the case. Here you can order a bread course, which gives you, you know, 3-4 kinds of breads that they've made freshly that day, along with their whipped butter.
I'm already in love with
this
concept.
There you go. But he's cooking, you know, all sorts of vegetables, you know, parsnips, potatoes, carrots, meats, fish. He even does a cocktail.
In the hearth.
In the hearth, he uses the red hot poker, heats it, and actually he adds it to the cocktail. And I'm not going to say this exactly correctly, but it allows some of the ingredients to caramelize inside this cocktail. And so he actually, you know, created a cocktail around that hearth, which I think is really smart. You know, if you've got this particular cooking source and this is what you're all about, you're going to try to use it in any way you can.
This is called playing to your strengths.
Exactly. Yeah.
So where is this place?
It is on Water Street.
I think it has East Pleasant.
It's Pleasant and Water.
Okay.
So it's that corner. If you know Denham Park, there's a Fresh Thyme right there. It's built into this sort of Barry Mandel kind of development over there. Very cool space. Modern. You know, if you're one of those people, you know, I recently saw a story It might have been The Guardian. I'm not sure. But it was about these modern restaurant spaces and how they don't do enough to muffle the noise quality.
Oh, I saw this as well, yes.
Which is a huge issue, you know. And this is one of those more modern spaces, and that's what designers really like. Now, this one, I think, really works for what they're doing. It's very sparse. It's very clean look to it. But, you know, that's another thing about a lot of these new restaurants. You're not seeing a lot of clothy, heavily upholstered restaurants these days. It just isn't what restaurants are doing.
Supper clubs notwithstanding, I guess.
Supper clubs notwithstanding. But, you know, we don't see a lot of them opening these days.
There's a restaurant that I've heard a lot about, but have never been. It's under the somewhat strange name for a restaurant, Third Coast Provisions. It kind of sounds like something that you would load up and take to the camp with you.
Right, but haven't you heard of sort of the Wisconsin Great Lakes region as the third coast?
Yes, yeah. I do know of that. Yeah.
So that is, you know, that's the premise here. Their whole focus is on fish and seafood. You know, however, Great Lakes fish being kind of a small part of it as they can get it in, but they're doing oysters, you know, so many different things that incorporate seafood, you know, lobster. They do something called lobster potholes. They've got little oyster po' boys. I mean, but then it goes all the way up to the whole market fish. So it gets really fancy. It's a two-level space, very cool, incredibly beautiful interior, light-infused space. Lower level is an oyster bar. Upper level is their kind of more fine dining dining room. And the way we handled it in the magazine, because I've written about this place before, we were thinking, well, what's a little different way of doing this? Well, what about pairings? Why not do a food and drink pairing? It helps diners sort of decide, well, maybe I'm not sure what I want to drink with this dish. But it features, you know, several dishes that I really like and what would be the best thing to drink with it. So, and then it has this sort of clean background, which really sort of reflects, I think, what they're all about.
You know, you sat down, and I think the first thing I said to you before we got the tape rolling was I looked at this list, and I had not been to any of them. I'm looking at this list again and realizing that I have been to number 5, which is Pizzeria San Giorgio, which is distinct because it is the only certified Neapolitan pizza place in the city of Milwaukee.
Yes. It's pretty rare. Yeah. I mean, you have to really jump through a lot of hoops to actually make that happen and to really, you know, you have to be trained. You have to have a very specific oven. You have to use very specific ingredients and you have to follow these rules. So what did you think?
You know, I really enjoy Neapolitan style pizza. It was very sparsely appointed, but honestly, I thought that the whole package was pretty nice. It was a comfortable restaurant. I thought the noise level was pretty good, and they treated me and the whole family fairly well. And I believe I was there fairly early on into their existence. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, you touched on, you know, the sparse ingredients on top of the pizza. That's a characteristic of that style of pizza. The crusts tend to have this charring on the bottom in very specific places.
It's very different than the Milwaukee style crust.
Correct. Which, the end crust is very pillowy. The actual middle of the pie is almost soupy. That's very common. There are lots of these styles of pies if you go to Italy where they don't put cheese on them at all, or maybe it's just chunks of buffalo mozzarella. That's very traditional. But to us, to have a pizza that's just laden in cheese and toppings, that's a more American style. It's not a Neapolitan style pizza.
Right. I think if you go to it expecting what you get at any one of the sort of vaunted Milwaukee, you know, traditional pizza places, you're going to be surprised.
Yes, but isn't that great that we have all these different styles of pizza
exactly.
that we can choose from?
I also wanted to mention number 6 on the list because it is in an unexpected place, 20th and West Wisconsin.
Right, the Papa Yo-Yo.
Yeah.
Asian Papa Yo-Yo. That is a really interesting space, partly because not only is that a really interesting restaurant, they focus on Malaysian cuisine, which is kind of like you definitely will get Asian touches there. Like you think, you know, you have the rice, you have, you know, these stir fry ingredients. spices. Certain things will remind you of Asian cuisine. Other things will remind you a little bit of Indian cuisine. They do curries. They do kind of a pancake that's similar to a roti chennai. It's called roti chennai, but it's very similar to something you'd find in an Indian restaurant. But the flavors are so wonderful. Now, that restaurant hasn't been there that long. And prior to it, there was a restaurant called Mendi, which was also a big favorite of mine. However, it's unfortunate that Wisconsin Avenue lately has been ripped up because of all the construction over there. It's very difficult to get to restaurants over there. So I'm really hoping that that doesn't, you know, doesn't hurt it.
So you wrote about a whole bunch of these, and I guess I wanted to give you, as we have just a couple minutes left, the chance to touch on, you know, one or two that you really wanted to mention.
I love mentioning Strangetown, and actually, in this case, also Celesta, because I have got two vegan restaurants. That's something, you know, that, you know, some people might say, oh, that's just a trend, vegan dining. I really think it's something that's going to stick around because there are so many more people that are following plant-based diets, whether it's for health reasons or ethical reasons, for the environment. I think going down the line, you're going to see it. We're going to see a lot more of this.
But to stick around, they have to have good food.
They have to have good food, and they have to evolve. In the past, we've seen with restaurants that are completely plant-based or vegetarian, you tend to see these places where there's a lot of things that are deep-fried tofu, you know, something they want to make something just like it is in its carnivorous form, but they want to sort of fool you in its plant-based. You know what I mean? It doesn't need to be that way. And I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing much more interesting, inventive, really delicious, palatable, and satisfying food. Even in Wisconsin, which is we're into our beef here. We're incredibly meat and potatoes oriented, still in some traditional forms. Plants are having an actual. I'm not quite sure it's ever had a foothold here,
but I think it's not a resurgence, but a surgence.
There we go. Yeah.
Sounds great. And thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
Ann Christensen is a senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine. Her article on best new restaurants is the cover story in the December issue.
Coming up, if you have ever wondered about the tugboat dock near the Michigan Street Bridge, you are not alone. Our Bubbler Talk series explores the history of the Solomon Juno when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
When Milwaukeeans hear the name Solomon Juno, it might ring a few bells. A founding father of the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee's first mayor. But Juno's name also belongs to an eye-catching red tugboat. It's docked year-round near the Michigan Street Bridge downtown. I'm Taryn Powell, and for this week's Bubbler Talk, a listener wanted to know the history of the Solomon Juno. So I contacted the boat's owner, Mark Gubin.
There's still no practical reason for having it. It's just madness, and you need madness in your life.
He's owned the tugboat since the early 1980s and gave it its name. But Gubin says it was decaying in a shipyard with other World War II vessels years before he came to own it.
My part that I know about is it started out in a shipyard that was left over from parts that were made for the Second World War's victory ships. It was originally called the Centurion, and it sat for a lot of years. It was built in 1903, sat for a lot of years, sort of falling into decay in this yard, and then they started building stuff in that same yard for the Second World War. Following the Second World War, the boat didn't really look like much of a boat anymore. It was mostly a skeleton, but a very nice hull as far as the shape of it. It was an icebreaker front. One of the welders there when the war was done said, could he have that? And nobody knew who it even belonged to, so they said, sure.
It was then turned into a fishing boat known as the Kevin Brand in the late 1940s and would keep that name until Gubin changed it.
Kevin Brand had been listed as sunk. Then it was brought up and rebuilt. Well, at that point, I didn't want to have a bad name for it because it had been in the papers, sunk, and if you brought up the Titanic, you wouldn't rename it the Titanic again. You had nobody at your parties.
Gubin says articles he's seen about the boat showed that it had its share of mishaps. Sometime in the 1950s, during the winter, it was lost on the lake for 3 days. And it once went under during a botched fishing expedition. But Gubin was able to give the boat a new life.
I always sort of liked the shape of the hull and thought that could be something. It just needs a lot of work. I started working on it little by little and getting parts from all kinds of other boats. This thing was already made out of parts from other boats anyhow. But it's not exactly sure who built it, because we all did.
Gubin says with the work he and others put into it, the boat looks like it originally did in 1903. He has also equipped it with luxuries like a fireplace and, down below, a sauna. Gubin says the Solomon Juno is his condo downtown from time to time. The boat has hosted family excursions and was even his son's dorm room while he was in college. And
I had a hell of a lot of parties on it. I mean, and used to dive off of it and stuff like that. We put a under the radar dome at the top. I had a diving board and all my friends, and then my son, daughter, and things got older. They'd all play on it and take them out to different places. And on weekends, sometimes I'd go over to Oklahoma Beach with it and spend the weekend there. It was sort of fun, like being out in the middle of nowhere kind of thing with the beach not too far away and have campfires on the beach and stuff.
The boat has often caught people's eye. Some have even been famous.
One time I was down there around, had to be somewhere near Christmas a number of years ago, and doing something on the boat, and it was just a good respite to get away from things. And all these ladies looked just about the same age and all that, and they were all rather pretty. And they started asking about it, and I said, well, you all look sort of the same and everything. Where are you from? And they said, oh, we're the Rockettes. And there was like five of them, and they did this little thing for a while up there. This is pretty neat, you know.
Even national magazines have done stories about Gubin's boat.
I never thought it would be that. I never thought of it in the world like that.
Couples have been married on the Solomon Juno, and it even had a personal security guard for 3 years, a seagull Gubin affectionately named Frank, who has his own statue atop the boat's wheelhouse. You might catch Gubin there one day, weather permitting, out on the hammock reading a book or relaxing with friends. So much life, so much character in the Solomon Juno, a jewel along the river.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Milwaukee, serving more than 41,000 children and teens each year. Dedicated to providing safe spaces, academic enrichment programs, and fun environments. More at bgcmilwaukee.org. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk is a regular series on Lake Effect, and it wraps up today's show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Mitch and I produced the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Mayan Silver, Bonnie North, and assistant producer Maddie Andre.
We get additional support from digital producer Lauren Sigfusson and additional reporting from the WUWM newsroom, including this week, Taryn Powell and Angelina Mosher-Salazar. Jason Reedy is our studio engineer, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.